From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a look at homicides in the city of Milwaukee with Reggie Moore, director of the Office of Violence Prevention. Then gardening expert Melinda Myers joins us with some tricks of the trade for planting your lawn this fall.
This year, we escaped a lot of drought. We only had a couple of dry weeks, and so most of our lawns stayed green. But heat and drought usually have our lawns going dormant unless you water, and the weeds thriving. So it was a great weed year, but it was also a good year for our grass.
Plus, actor and comedian Nick Offerman describes how his character Ron Swanson helps him with his stand-up routine.
You have enjoyed me talking about both bacon and eggs in the past, but now let's talk about human rights for a second, and let's see if I can just keep you with me. And here's a song about carrying a handkerchief.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. As the weather cools down, so do the levels of violent crime in cities throughout the country, which is why August is one of the months with the highest levels of violent crime in Milwaukee annually. By that measure, the city has been making some progress. There were 10 homicides in the city of Milwaukee this past August, compared to 22 over the same month last year. But the city has still experienced more than 60 devastating homicides this year to date. A 3-year-old was shot and killed in an alleged road rage incident. A community advocate was shot and killed near a park where she had been planning youth activities. Another woman was shot and killed in an alleged road rage incident while she was teaching her 17-year-old son how to drive. Reggie Moore is director of Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about his office's efforts to curb violence in our city, as well as the obstacles.
So since the development and launch of the Blueprint for Peace in 2017, there really has been a concerted effort of bringing as many segments of the community together to engage in violence prevention. And I think it's producing results. When you look at this August alone, so when we look at summer in general, right, we look at the bookends. So typically Memorial Day on the front end, and then we look at Labor Day on the back end. And so for the first time, I think in 7 years, for Memorial Day, we had no homicides in the city. This Labor Day, we had no homicides, but unfortunately we had 2 non-fatal shootings. And then last year in August alone, in 2018, if you recall, there were 14 homicides in the first 15 days of August 2018. And we ended August of 2018 with a total of 22 homicides. This year, we only had 10. And so in terms of all of the activity, all of the engagement, all of the concerted effort to prevent and respond to violence in our city, I think is having an impact. And so this is the type of effort that we need to see supported and sustained.
Well, and that's what you've been doing this entire time, is looking at violence as a public health issue. What do you see as the pluses and potential obstacles to that mode of working against violence?
The biggest obstacle has been getting people to believe that violence is preventable. We have suffered with so much pain and trauma in our city for so long that people almost made peace with trauma. And I would argue that we should never make peace with pain or with trauma. We should do everything possible to prevent it. And so we may not be able to stop every shooting, right? When you look at random road rage incidents that result in somebody pulling a gun in an argument, that's hard to predict. And, you know, without a targeted intervention with that person, it's hard to prevent those sort of random acts of violence. But when we look at where violence is occurring and what the drivers of violence are, if we can take a place-based approach to say, are there certain neighborhoods with high incidence of non-fatal shootings and high incidence of homicides? If we can look at social networks to say, you know, our community is highly connected, like people know everybody, you know what I mean, in terms of you're probably 2 or 3 people away removed from people who are personally touched by violence in this city. And so we get information pretty quickly about what's happening or what's brewing in the street, and we try to take a more proactive approach to get ahead of it. And that's why, you know, we launched the 41 for Life program in partnership with United Garden Homes and Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin, as well as Ascension Healthcare, to really on the front end try to mediate and prevent shootings before they happen. But then on the back end, how do we intervene to reduce the likelihood of retaliation? Most of the shootings in our city are the result of arguments and fights and conflict-related shootings that could be prevented if somebody would step up and be the peacemaker. And so we also try to encourage, promote, and support individuals being what I would call upstanders as opposed to bystanders. So if you know of something that's brewing, or, you know, you're at the club with your friends and there's a fight or argument that's escalating, somebody in that group basically intervening and saying, look, bro, look, sis, like, this isn't worth it. In the event that that doesn't happen or somebody does not do that, I think 414 Life is a stopgap to be able to say, is there somebody you can call, because this particular conflict runs deep and it's been going on for so long that it's going to take more than, you know, a simple conversation. And so that's where our trained interrupters can get involved, and they're from the street. So they understand the life. They understand a lot of the dynamics that drive street violence and gun violence, and have the ability to be able to intervene in a way to de-escalate a situation in a credible way. And so those are all the things that we're doing from a proactive perspective to try to reduce violence in the city, while at the same time calling for addressing some of the systemic factors in terms of concentrated poverty, concentrated mass incarceration, all of the things that create and destabilize families and neighborhoods that also create conditions for violence to flourish.
Can you break down 414 Life, like just in simple terms, what it is?
So 414 Life is a public health approach that looks at violence as a communicable disease. So the reason, for example, why we have our trauma response partnership with Milwaukee County, the police department, the fire department, and others, is that children who are exposed to violence are more likely to either be victimized by it or perpetuate it in the future, because, again, violence becomes normalized. If I grow up in a house where I see a family member being beaten or violated every day, or when I go in my community and I see most of the conflicts being resolved with fistfights or gunshots, I believe that that's the way that I'm supposed to resolve conflict, or the way that I'm supposed to work through my trauma in terms of abusing other people. And so to the degree that we can break that cycle and understand that we have to, one, be responsive when trauma happens and make sure children get access to counseling immediately, but then we also have to stop that transmission. So with 414 Life specifically, it really is about what we call health workers who are trained in a model that's modeled after the Cure Violence model out of Chicago, that's been implemented in about 70 cities around the world, that basically trains folks from the community who have the background and credibility to be able to predict where conflicts are brewing, to engage with individuals who are part of that conflict, and try to de-escalate a conflict before it escalates to the point of physical or gun violence. And so that's essentially that's a huge component of the program. And the hospital partnership allows the interrupters to be paged to the hospital when a gunshot survivor who meets our criteria, meaning folks who are at highest risk of either being re-injured due to gun violence or actually engaging in some form of retaliation, we engage with both the family and the survivor to try to break that cycle and to support that person's recovery physically and psychologically as they recover from being injured by gun violence.
Who are the interrupters? How do you pick them, and what do they do?
So it's a very intensive recruitment process. So we put out a call into the community for folks that are interested in learning conflict mediation and being a part of or engaging in some form of peace building in the city. From that point, the process gets a lot more intensive, right? So we do the sort of open call just to build a list of people who are at least interested in this work. But as we drill down, there's a hiring panel that involves folks from the community, people who have been involved in violence in the city, the health department. It is a very intensive in terms of interview process. Also, members of Cure Violence are part of that hiring panel, because what we want to make sure, number one, is there are people who want to do good, and there are many ways to do good in this city. This is very volatile work, and it takes a high level of credibility and a person that is extremely committed to addressing this issue and not having sort of one foot in, one foot out in terms of the life, but have made a conscious decision and commitment to living a violence-free life. And so I'm really proud of the team that we've recruited. They've been working since November 2018, and all of them don't necessarily have a criminal background, some of them. But again, the critical criteria is the courage, the commitment, and the competence to engage in high risk and high intensity violence prevention work in the city.
And how many incidents do you think they've been involved in and potentially stemmed from happening, turning into violence?
Right. So in terms of conflicts mediated in the street, there's been approximately 64. In terms of hospital referrals, in terms of gunshot victims that have been referred by Frederick Hospital, there's been about 71 of those individuals. And 100% of the patients that have been asked, would you like to talk to a violence interrupter, have accepted. So, you know, in the street,
sometimes. Wow, that's interesting.
Right. So you may not have a person on the street that may not be receptive to the message or may not be in a place that they want to change their life. But if you've been shot 3 or 4 times and you're laying in a hospital bed in recovery, you're more apt to that message. And so we want to do everything possible to stop that person from being re-injured. And number two, from feeling like they need to now carry a gun or retaliate against the person who shot them. It really is about bringing folks together, working together, leveraging policies and resources that can seriously address this issue in our city. And we're seeing results.
Talking about those results, do those people, those dozens of individuals who've been shot, who are working with interrupters, get out of the hospital? Have you been seeing results with those individuals?
Right. So some of the things that we track as a result of the 41 for Life program is re-injury. We also are tracking in partnership with Frater their follow-up support in terms of participating in psych services, because understanding the PTSD that comes from being shot. And so we're actually right now, preliminary data is showing that folks are actually going to their follow-up visits. And so that's extremely, from a mental health perspective, important, but also from a physical recovery perspective is important. We also track in terms of attitudes and behaviors around gun carrying and gun usage among the participants. We call them participants in terms of the caseload that the interrupters support. So it's not just a one touch or one engagement. It really is about working with folks over a period of time and really being committed to their physical recovery, but also their psychological recovery, and then supporting them in terms of housing, employment, AYODA, and other mental health supports and needs. I mean, not just of that individual, but of the family. If someone has been shot, for example, in their home, and their home was shot up, they may not want to return to that house when they're discharged from the hospital. And they also are concerned about their loved ones who lived in the house with them. And so ensuring that the children have access to counseling and mental health supports, ensuring that in terms of loss of income and other issues that could lead to eviction that come as a result of one gunshot. So there's data and research being done around the country that's looking at the cost of gunshot wounds. And the data that we're seeing in terms of looking at cities like St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago, Minneapolis, is that the average cost of one gunshot victim and one perpetrator is $1 million. That involves the detective and investigative costs. That involves the hospital costs. It involves the incarceration of the perpetrator and the prosecution of that perpetrator. It also involves, in terms of lost tax revenue, of both the individual that's sent away to prison and then the person who has to recover. And a lot of times there are public health costs in terms of, you know, costs for that person's hospital care because they may be un- or underinsured. And so those are all factors that go into when we talk about gun violence, both as a moral issue, but also as a fiscal issue. It is imperative that we get smarter on public safety by investing in prevention. So if you think about, you know, both combined street and hospital-based interventions, about 140 people have been served as a result of this program, which could have resulted likely in 140 prevention of gunshot victims, and you multiply that by $1 million, it is the return on investment in prevention is clear. The question is there the political will at every level, at the local, state, and federal level to invest in the prevention to the degree that it deserves? Because unfortunately, as a society, as a country, and as a state, we have not done that. And so it really is critical, and this is the critical juncture now where we have to really step up and be responsive to what the community has told us in the Blueprint for Peace that we should be doing to prevent and reduce violence in this city.
Why do you think we are seeing so many road rage incidents in Milwaukee?
Some would debate that as a result of CCW, whether people are carrying legally or illegally or inappropriately, that people are driving around with firearms in their car. And again, when there's an argument or a conflict, obviously, you know, tempers may flare up in a car accident. You're on your way home or on your way to work or wherever and you end up in a car accident and you're upset because you're thinking about everything that comes with a car accident, right, in terms of increased insurance costs and the inconvenience of losing transportation, all of that understandably creates a level of anxiety and anger and frustration. The problem is when that escalates and individuals actually have firearms in their car, people, again, are making split-second emotional decisions in a moment to pull a gun out and kill somebody over something that's not worth a life. And so, you know, again, you know, people can argue in terms of mental health. They can argue a range of different issues. And again, I don't think road rage is new. I think, you know, there's been incidents of road rage where people get out and fight each other physically. I think what the equation is now people are resorting to lethal means in a moment of rage. And that's something that we have to really grapple with as a community. And really have to have conversations in our homes about, is it ideal to drive around with a firearm in your car? And again, we know that people purchase firearms, you know, for home and protection and things like that. But at the end of the day, it is definitely increasing incidents where people are resorting to lethal means to resolve conflicts that could be resolved by legal means, conversation, etc. And shooting somebody over a car accident or being cut off in traffic is completely unacceptable.
Do you find that the Office of Violence Prevention is doing any lobbying or submitting any reports to the legislature when it comes to gun policy?
So the city of Milwaukee has been advocating around gun policy for a while. I think the juncture that we're at now is, unfortunately, the state legislator seems to react when there's sort of a mass shooting or a series of mass shootings in the country. And so when you look at, for example, last year after the Parkland shooting, where Scott Walker was able to pass an executive order to allocate $100 million to fortify school buildings, I think the question comes down to, how do we fortify our communities? I think when you look at the daily gun violence that happens in cities across this country, there has not been a windfall of resources to address the daily gun violence that happens in cities across this country, which quadruple the number of people killed in mass shootings in any given year. And so at the end of the day, I think now we have to, again, we have an opportunity to have a comprehensive request, not just a policy request. Policy request is absolutely important, and we support universal background checks. We support red flag laws, but we also need resources for comprehensive violence prevention strategies in local communities. And so things like 414 Life are supported in New York by local funding, but also by state funding. Maryland also has a statewide violence prevention fund. California has a statewide violence prevention fund, and we need one in Wisconsin. And so we need the state legislature as well as the governor to take leadership on this issue and be comprehensive in addressing gun violence in Wisconsin in a complete way, not just looking at policies and laws, because again, those things are important. But at the end of the day, for those that are not going to be deterred by a law or increased penalties, we have to deal with the source of the violence and the source of the trauma. And things like 414 Life and other interventions called for in the Blueprint for Peace require resources that, unfortunately, Milwaukee doesn't have. We're cash strapped as a result of the status of state share revenue currently in the state that has to be addressed. And so I'm really, you know, calling on state leadership to step up.
Reggie Moore, thank you.
Thank you.
Reggie Moore is the director of Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention, and he spoke with WUWM reporter Mayan Silver. You can find out more information about Moore's work at WUWM.com. Coming up, if you think the cool weather meant the end of gardening season, think again. Gardening expert Melinda Myers joins us next. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you. continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As summer turns to fall, many fair-weather gardeners begin to pack up their tools and head inside. But there's still much to be done. Every month, Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers talks to us about all things gardening. Myers is the author of several books on the topic, including Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin. And she is here in studio with me now. Melinda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Always a pleasure.
It seems like September is the time to really start focusing on your lawn and grass care. So let's start here. How can the summer impact your lawn?
Often our summers are hot and dry. This year we escaped a lot of drought. We only had a couple of dry weeks, and so most of our lawn stayed green. But heat and drought usually have our lawns going dormant unless you water and the weeds thriving. So it was a great weed year, but it was also a good year for our grass. A lot of heat and drought, usually not so much this year. Early, we had so much rain, and so too much water can be detrimental as well. The lawns seemed to survive unless they were underwater. That can damage the roots and so show up later. And then insects aren't the biggest problem here in Wisconsin, but we do occasionally see things like grubs from the Japanese beetles eating the roots of our grass, chinch bugs, which can feed on the plants as well, and then aphids. So a few insects, not many, but it's usually heat and drought that really stress our lawns. Some diseases because of all the rain this spring. So you put all that together when we're out enjoying the lawn, we're playing on the grass, we're cutting it with the mower, so we're adding to some of the compaction of the soil just by all the activity on our grass.
So something that we had in my lawn this year, and I think it was a number of different things that really impacted this, but we had a patch that had grass and then just suddenly, you know, was really just kind of a mud pile. And with all of the rain, it just became even more of just a mud pile. So we're starting to regrow grass there really from the start. If you're somebody who is just starting off a lawn like that, what should you be doing?
A good point. So take advantage of this bad opportunity, right? You're thinking, ugh, the last thing I want to do is overseed or reseed. But if you have dead patches, adding some organic matter, compost, peat moss to the top, I say 12 inches, hoping you give me 6 or 8. What that does is a couple things. It improves drainage. So many people in southern Wisconsin have heavy clay soil, so it improves the drainage. Those that have rock and sand, it'll help hold the moisture. Adding organic matter also helps when we have all this rain that we've been having in the last few years, so it acts like a sponge. So instead of it running off the lawn into our storm sewer, it's absorbed. And then improving the drainage, it helps filter it down to the groundwater, cleaning out a lot of the dirt and the impurities. So it helps manage stormwater as well as help improve your lawn. And then you're going to rake that. Well, first get rid of the dead stuff. I should have started there. Get rid of the dead stuff if there's anything left. Wait until the soil's moist but not soggy wet. Take a handful of soil, gently squeeze, tap it. If it breaks into pieces, it's moist, perfect for working. If it stays in a mud ball, wait, because you're going to have cracked, compacted soil. And you don't want to spend all this effort to create a new problem. So we've got our soil prepped. And whether you're seeding or sodding, soil preparation is key to longevity. So then we can lay our sod this is a perfect time to seed your lawn. The soil's warm, the air is cool, and the grasses we grow are cool season grasses, bluegrass and fescue and perennial rye, and they thrive in the cooler temperatures of spring and fall. And that's why they did pretty well this summer too, because we had mostly cooler weather. So then you're going to lightly rake the seed in if you're seeding. You're going to lay the sod if you're going to lay sod, kind of in the pattern like a brick. So you alternate your seams, and then you kind of butt the edges up so that when that sod shrinks a little bit, you'll still have grass there, not a bunch of cracks in the lawn. And then you're going to keep the soil moist. Now, with the cooler weather, that helps us. A lot of rain we've had, that helps. But with seed, you're going to check it every day. And you might be watering at least once a day, maybe twice if we get some warm temperatures, just keeping that top inch or so moist, not soggy wet. With sod, you're going to water thoroughly, again, keeping the soil surface moist because you want those roots to net into the soil below. So you're going to have to do a lot of watering initially. Now, the sod will start to root in a week or so. You gently tug. Then you can back off, water thoroughly and less frequently. As your grass sprouts, then you can do the same, water thoroughly and less frequently. It takes bluegrass up to 3 weeks to sprout. You know, with the warmer soil, maybe a little less. Perennial rye is usually mixed in with our grass seed mixes for quick cover. That's usually up in a week to 2 weeks. So the first thing you have is perennial ryegrass. Then your bluegrass and fescues come in. Perennial ryegrass isn't always long-lived in the lawn. It's just a placeholder. And it won't overtake your lawn and create problems. Some will survive. And a lot of people use perennial rye for fixing problem areas or high traffic areas as a short-term solution. So we've got our grass started. The one thing I forgot to mention is fertilization. So if you have an established lawn or you're starting a lawn, this is a great time to fertilize. Research found that fall fertilization is probably the best thing we can do for our lawns. And Labor Day is about the time you want to do it. So Labor Day, early September. So if you're doing some seeding, you could fertilize the whole lawn, including that spot you're seeding, and using a low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizer, something like Milwaukee's own Milorganite, it won't burn or damage those seedlings or the sod. And that way you can do it both tasks at once. Fertilize your whole lawn as well as those areas you're repairing. Or if you're starting a lawn, you can incorporate the fertilizer in with the organic matter when you do your soil prep. Then you're going to watch the grade, so it grades away from the house, get rid of any big chunks. Then you could do your seeding and sodding if you're starting over totally.
That was one of my questions, I guess. When you have these kinds of patches that are popping up that maybe it's completely bare or maybe it's just, you know, kind of yellowed and not gone very well, are there certain ways to deal with that while also ensuring that the rest of your lawn is being cared for properly?
You know, good question. And one of the things is always to figure out why did that happen? You know, and one of the things when I talk to someone with a lawn problem, tell me a little bit, when did this start appearing? Has it been every year? You know, if you have this problem every year, it might be compacted soil, so it's not draining. If it was just this year and water was standing, it could be some root rot. If you can pull your grass up, you know, if you have nothing there to pull up, you know, that's probably not grubs. Grubs, if you pull up the top and there are no roots, you probably, at this time of year, the Japanese beetles are just starting to lay their eggs in the grass. And so you may see some grubs, but they eat the roots of the plants. And so it's doing a little bit of investigation. Some diseases like melting out, which is helminthosporine leaf spot, causes the grass to kind of turn brown, yellow brown, and then it just melts away. And they call it melting out. Now, I've seen people treat for the disease and not treat for the disease. And at the end of 3 years, the lawns look the same because you're going to overseed. Get a good mix of bluegrass and fescue. So several varieties. When you read the bag, it should have several varieties of bluegrass, several varieties of fescue. Bluegrass, great in the sun. Fescue, more shade tolerant. But if you have a variety of varieties, then you have more disease resistance. And so overseeding with disease-resistant grass seed or looking for sod that's known for being resistant is going to help build that up. So that resistance, so you don't have the problem hopefully down the road.
So if you're somebody who's incorporated grasses that are native to Wisconsin into your lawn, how would you care for them this time of year?
So typically if you're using native grasses, you probably have them in either a garden bed versus popping up within your grass, your lawn. And so those native grasses are typically in a garden. And the good news about those is they don't require a lot of care. Enjoy their beauty. This is usually when those native grasses are really starting to shine. They're producing flowers and then seeds. They bring in the birds. A lot of caterpillars feed on the leaves. They're going to go into their glory in fall. Leave them stand for winter. One, you can enjoy them. Two, it increases the hardiness. And then the last thing is in late winter or spring, I typically like to cut them back so that we let the sun reach them. They warm up and they outcompete the weeds. Chop up. You can put the tops in your compost pile, chop them up. And really, they need very little, if any, fertilization. So those native grasses are a great addition. And all your grasses, a healthy lawn or a natural planting, help capture rainwater so it doesn't run in the storm. So it helps their roots help filter that water before it goes to the groundwater. And one of the reasons I like to talk about lawns as well as the native grasses is a lot of people have lawns. And so I want to help people have a healthy lawn with minimal use of chemicals so that we can really take good care of our waterways as well as our landscape and bring in those birds and those other pollinators as well.
So we've really mostly focused on lawn care. But, you know, when we're talking about fall and we're talking about different plants that might be coming in, what are some of the, you know, fruits. Actually, this is a fruit. I know that squash are fruit. So what are some of the fruits?
Very good. And most people don't. You know, one of the things is it is harvest season. And so knowing when to pick is the greatest thing because you'll get the best flavor and most nutritional value. So if you've got zucchini, this has been a great summer to try to keep up with them. I'll tell you, I've made a lot of zucchini bread because I waited a day or two too long and I had big zucchini fruit to make bread and not so good when they slice them and fry them and do that. Winter squash, you know, needs to have that rind turn nice and hard, still be glossy. On the underside where it sits on the ground, it usually turns from a green to a cream or an orange color, and you know it's ripe. So that mostly have a little bit longer depending on when you planted. Watermelons are, I love watermelon, and it can be tricky. And if you get a short season one, especially with our cool summers, you'll be okay. The tendrils near the top start to dry up and curl. And again, the rind is hard, and you kind of get that thud thud when you tap on it. Melons actually start, the vine starts cracking, the stem starts cracking away from the vine. So it tells you it's ready to harvest. Tomatoes, this has been a tough year for those waiting for their first red ripe tomatoes. I'm going to have a lot of tomatoes, I think, in the end of September. It's been so cool that it's delayed harvesting. So wait until they're fully colored. If the animals aren't going to eat them, give them another 5 days on the vine. They'll be even sweeter. I have a lot of ground squirrels, like so many people, right?
Yep.
And if you wait too long, I found one. I'd picked it, set it down, forgot about it, went back. It was half eaten. I was eliminated the problem of climbing up the plant to eat my tomato. So I've been picking mine a little underripe only so that I have some ripe tomatoes. So I put them on my counter. Let them ripen up for a couple of days. You can put some in the basement to slow it down, a cooler room anyway. And hopefully we won't have a killing frost for a while, but you can pick your tomatoes as long as they're turning a light green at the bottom or starting to show any color, whether it's yellow, orange, or red, depending on the variety. And you can ripen those inside as well.
Great. Well, Melinda Myers, thanks as always for coming in and speaking with us about lawn care, all things gardening, and sharing so much of your work.
My pleasure. And for tips on just keeping water where it falls, see FreshCoastGuardians.com.
Melinda Myers is the author of several books on gardening, and she's a regular contributor to Lake Effect. You can find more of our conversations with her at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then the venerable comedian and actor, Nick Offerman, joins us next ahead of his show in Milwaukee. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If all you know about Nick Offerman is his Parks and Recreation character, Ron Swanson, then you're missing out. Although he's extremely proud of Swanson, the accomplished actor, comedian, and master woodworker has a lot more to offer audiences. Offerman will be showcasing his stand-up and music chops this Thursday evening at the Riverside Theater in a show called All Rise. He promises dancing, ukulele playing, and fashion tips for woodworking. A child of the Midwest, Offerman is happy to be back in Milwaukee, telling Lake Effect's Bonnie North that he yearns for, well, the Lake Effect.
Nick Offerman, welcome to Lake Effect. It is a pleasure to have you on the show.
It is my pleasure. I yearn for the Lake Effect.
Do you? Yes, you're from Illinois.
I am. I'm very much a son of the Great Lakes. Living on the West Coast is beautiful in many ways, but they just can't turn out a bratwurst like my hometown.
No. I imagine. I have friends out in L.A., and no, there's not really any good bratwurst. I have noticed that.
There's not, and you would think it wouldn't be that difficult.
Well, maybe in your copious free time, that's something you could do.
Perhaps. That is a really good idea. Stand by
okay.
for Offerman's brats and curds.
We're ready. I'll come out.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I assume you're going to have some when you come here.
I love the people and the culture, but I'm coming for the curds. There's no two ways about it. I lose weight so that I can then visit Milwaukee and pack a few back on.
And so let's talk about All Rise, what you're bringing to Milwaukee. I love the idea of deliberative talking and light dance, as opposed to deliberative dance and light talking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my dance is surprisingly effervescent. There's almost no deliberation to be detected in the dancing. So it's something that's come to me late, this whole stand-up comedy touring thing. I'm a theater-trained actor. I cut my teeth in Chicago, and only during Parks and Recreation did colleges begin to invite me to perform as a comedian. And at first I demurred and said, of course, well, why no? I'm a trained thespian. I'm no Rodney Dangerfield. And then eventually I said, well, wait a second. There are some things I would really like to say to 2,000 young people in a college audience. So I started writing stand-up material, and I just am crazy about it. It's really fun. And so this is my third tour. And Milwaukee is only like the fourth show of the domestic tour, and so it's going to be quite fresh. And my favorite thing about the show is these songs that I write. I just really love the acoustic guitar and a sort of clumsy folk musicality as a joke delivery system. It seems to go over very well with Wisconsinites.
Did you find that the kind of work that you were doing at Steppenwolf, you mentioned cutting your teeth in Chicago theater, I mean, that's a lot of improv. Really amazing work comes out of there. Has that helped putting this show together?
Well, sure. I mean, I have to presume that everything I do cumulatively snowballs into the mediocre donkey that you have on the other end of the line. But the thing about performers is, especially in the theater side, you try to pack your toolbox in an effective way so that you can perform in whatever is on the season. So if it's a very broad comedy, you get out your clown nose, and if it's Shakespeare, you know, you get out your dagger and your skull and everything in between. So I didn't actually have any improv training. I just always liked making people laugh. And then once I got cast on Parks and Recreation, I was able to then indulge with some great improvisers and sort of learn my chops working on that show.
Did that surprise you how that show took off and how your character, Ron Swanson, took off?
Well, yes, only because I'm by the time I got that big break of the role of Ron Swanson, I had become well aware of how impossible show business is in general. And so I had high hopes because I knew we had the same kernel of brilliant writing that had created The American Office. And so it's always a question mark. If you spin a show off of a brilliant creation, will it be as brilliant, or will it, you know, will it be... a good example is the show Joey that was spun off of Friends. They're just, despite the charisma of the performing, there's just something missing. And so I was hopeful that Parks and Rec would resonate with the audience the way it did. But I have to say, it surpassed my expectations and continues to do so. As to the success of Ron Swanson, that absolutely has been the most wonderful professional surprise of my life. I always thought that I could do a decent job. You know, I was brought up with a good work ethic, and so I knew that I could entertain people and that they would hopefully not leave disappointed, but I never imagined that I'd be teamed up with such brilliant writers that they would be able to take the bale of flax that I am and spin it into a most effective silken gown.
I don't know if Ron would think of himself as a silken gown, though. Would he?
Oh, hell no. Ron, I don't think Ron has the ability to think of himself, period.
One of the things I always loved about watching you in that character is that you have somehow joined the ranks of the great deadpan actors in that role. And I know from working in the theater a little bit myself, that is very difficult to do.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I believe I come by it honestly. It began for me in the Catholic Church in my hometown of Minooka, Illinois. I was an altar boy, and then as a teenager, they had me do the gospel readings. And it was then that I learned if I could keep a straight face, I could make my cousins and my friends laugh with the severity of my elocution, all the while thrilling the rest of the congregation with the effect of my vocal tone. And so, and I was always drawn to deadpan performances. I always cite the examples of Jeffrey Jones, who played the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and an actor named Paul Gleason, who was the principal in The Breakfast Club. Mm-hmm. Something about these sort of over-severe authority figures who took themselves way too seriously, and which rendered them humorless, and then which then in turn made them hilarious to the rest of us. For some reason, that struck a chord with me, and I said, I think I can grow some crops in that particular field.
Well, and you did. Absolutely, you did. Now that you're doing, and I know this is not the first solo tour you've done, but was the switch from working with that wonderful cast on Parks and Rec, was it difficult to shift from having that kind of instant feedback difficult, you know, when you're kind of depending on yourself on stage?
The biggest change that I have had to deal with is in going from portraying a role, a fictional role that someone has written. You know, I've always been protected. I can do anything, including very embarrassing things on stage or on screen, because it's not me. I have the safety of the mask of the theater. I can take off my clothes and reveal my embarrassing waistline because it's not me, it's the character, and it's him that drinks too much. And so touring as a comedian, that's what struck me the most was, oh, I've never presented myself on stage as just myself. And so so that took some getting used to, but fortunately I'm incredibly spoiled because of the ambassadorship of Ron Swanson. He has preceded me into almost any space. And so thanks to the wonderful team at Parks and Rec, when I show up at the Riverside Theater, a lot of the audience says, oh, we already like something this guy did, so we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt. And so, you know, I am no dummy. I lean on that and say, okay, I know You have enjoyed me talking about both bacon and eggs in the past. But now let's talk about human rights for a second, and let's see if I can just keep you with me. And here's a song about carrying a handkerchief. Now, the other part of your question is, I do really miss, you know, without having teammates on stage, without being in an ensemble, as we had on Parks and Rec, the entire load falls on me. And that's something that I absolutely miss because, you know, the cast of Parks and Recreation was just an astonishing assemblage of talent. And almost all of them were incredibly energetic. They were each in their own way. They are comedy dynamos. And so that allowed me to stand there and be quiet. And then all I had to do was say one small thing at the end of their, you know, explosive monologue. And people would say, oh, what a great comedy duo. And all I did was hold my coffee cup and shake my head. You know, I knew very much upon which side my bread was buttered.
Would you ever consider doing a similar kind of ensemble casting again, or have you been spoiled?
I've definitely been spoiled. I mean, I've worked on a great many television shows and film sets, and the atmosphere created by Mike Schur, the main creator of Parks and Rec, along with Greg Daniels and Amy Poehler, and then we have a producer named Morgan Sackett, who's an incredible sort of unsung hero. There's always somebody on a production that really makes everything happen. It's sort of the parent, the mom or dad, who has the checkbook and is literally arranging the entire family trip, as it were. And so, you know, the tour guide gets a lot of play, the kids get a lot of attention, but the person who's actually pulling all the strings, if they've done their job right, nobody ever knows their name. And that's Morgan Sackett. He also produced the show Veep and The Good Place. And so the atmosphere that these people create is so loving and positive, and that's really perhaps the rarest thing about working on Parks and Rec. I absolutely would love to do another show. And so at the moment, I have a new show coming out in early 2020 that's a sci-fi thriller called Devs, D-E-V-S, on the FX network. And it's made by this incredible filmmaker named Alex Garland, an Englishman who made the movies Ex Machina and Annihilation. Mm. He's just an absolutely brilliant artist, the type I'm always looking to work with. He's a novelist first. He wrote the novel The Beach, which became the film The Beach. And his films and this eight-hour series, eight one-hour episodes, he in them he tends to explore the question of what kind of trouble will we human beings get into as our technology is becoming too effective? You know, this particular series has to do with quantum physics and quantum computing. And it's always something that we're on the cusp of. His movie Ex Machina deals with AI. What's going to happen to us when our AI becomes too human? And in our series, it asks the question, you know, when our computers become too powerful, what kind of trouble are we going to get into? And so, you know, I'm really thrilled to be involved in it. And I'm lucky that this kind of work keeps coming my way, because one of the traps of a successful role like Ron Swanson, one of the worries is that people will no longer allow you to appear as any other character. They'll say, no, that's Ron Swanson. I can't watch this. So far, the world seems to be letting me continue to grow, and I remain grateful.
Yeah. Well, and so do we, because I'm really looking forward to that one. Devs, D-E-V-S?
D-E-V-S, yeah, it stands for development.
Okay. Looking forward to, in 2020?
Yeah, the last I heard, it's coming out January of 2020.
Perfect. We will look for it. But in the meantime, we are looking forward to having you here in September. And Nick Offerman, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show.
Well, thank you. I have to say, when I started touring, I love the corridor. I mean, really, the Great Lakes area. Something about, there's a familial sense of the people just treat me like family. And when I got to Milwaukee, I mean, I love Wisconsin. I grew up, like, Wisconsin and Minnesota, that is heaven to my family. We've been all over both states, and we love the food and the beer and the baseball teams and the fishing. We're no stranger to the Dells, and you know, someday I hope to visit Door County as well. I hear that's pretty. But when I got to Milwaukee, I was just astonished that people showed up like it was my high school reunion or something. And so I'm always so grateful to both Milwaukee and Madison. The audiences are so generous, and it makes me work twice as hard to keep you laughing. So I look forward to seeing you in just a few weeks.
As do we. Thanks again so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Actor and comedian Nick Offerman will present his show All Rise this Thursday evening at the Riverside Theater. You can find out more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.